Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Today we take on the question, are corporations persons? Should they have constitutional rights and which ones? Since 1819, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized corporations as having the same rights as natural persons to contract and enforce contracts. On March 25th, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments for the case Hobby Lobby Stores Incorporated versus Sebelius. That's the controversial case that challenges the Affordable Care Act's mandate for businesses with more than 50 employees to provide insurance coverage for contraception. Hobby Lobby is a chain of over 500 arts and crafts stores employing about 22,000 people, owned by David Green and his family. Here's a clip from a video the Greens made about their case.
The country. The Green family built Hobby Lobby on biblical principles and their strong Christian faith and values. So when the federal government's Health and Human Services mandate threatened to force them to include abortion-inducing drugs in their health insurance plan, the Green family felt compelled to file a lawsuit in defense for their religious freedom. They are represented in this case by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. The Green family believes that life begins at conception, when an egg is fertilized. FDA guidelines clearly state that the morning after and the week after pill may prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the womb. This aborts a fertilized egg. The Green family has no objection to preventative birth control, and they will continue to cover this in their comprehensive health insurance plan for their employees. Hobby Lobby and the Green family do not wish to control the actions of their employees, nor do they want to impose their beliefs on anyone. They respect the religious convictions of all Americans, even those with different views. They are simply asking for that same respect with regards to their religious freedom. Religious freedom is one of our most cherished rights as Americans. We hope you agree. Thank you for listening.
And that was Mandy Broadfitt. She's a Hobby Lobby employee. The crux of that case comes down to a legal term called corporate personhood. Remember the Citizens United case from 2010? In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that money equals free speech. Well, the question of the First Amendment protection for corporations is back, and this time it's about religion. But really, it's about the concept of corporate personhood. So what does that really mean in today's legal landscape, and what's the relevance for you and me? To help us sort through all of this, we are joined by Tejinder Singh. He's an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. He's argued before the Supreme Court and lower courts on matters involving civil rights, financial regulation, privacy rights, environmental protection, intellectual property, and gaming law. Welcome, Tejinder. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're also joined by Jesse Choper. He's the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on the Supreme Court. Hi, Jesse.
Are you with us? Good
morning. Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Okay, so before we get into the minutiae and the specifics of the Hobby Lobby case, can you maybe, Jesse, start us off and explain this historical precedent for corporate personhood? It has a specific legal meaning.
Well, I think it's worth observing first that this is not a federal constitutional question, as was so in Citizens United. This involves a federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which sets certain standards that used to be part of a constitutional formula but are no longer for the free exercise of religion. And it simply says that if religion practices or beliefs come into conflict with a federal statute, as this one does, the Obamacare statute says that it has to be used by any employer who comes under it, and as a consequence, what happens is that this is an employer that happens to be a corporation. I think this would be a perfectly easy case if this were a private individual, a partnership or a sole proprietorship or something like that, but it's a corporation. And the peculiar thing about it, or the second special thing about it, is that it is a very closely held corporation, all of the shares of which are owned by the family, as the introductory remarks showed.
Okay, so Jesse, let me turn to Tejinder. Tejinder, can you explain to us this historical precedent for corporate personhood? What does that actually mean?
Sure. So a corporation is, in a sense, a person. It's a fictitious entity that the law allows regular, actual, flesh and blood human beings to create in order to conduct their affairs. And the corporate entity has certain advantages that allow us to conduct business better. So, for example, corporations live forever, unlike flesh and blood humans. Corporations have their own legal identity. They can sue and be sued in their own name, and that has the function of protecting their shareholders from liability for their debts. So if I have a corporation that runs my business and it incurs debts, you know, those debts are the corporation's debts, not my debts, outside of a very limited set of circumstances. And we've used corporations for centuries now, and before us they were around in England as well. And so as more and more of our daily life has come to be managed by corporate entities that we've created, this question has naturally arisen. You know, what rights do corporations have? And as you mentioned in the introductory comments, obviously they can enter into contracts. As I mentioned, they can sue and be sued. These rights are generally defined by state law. And now these questions are arising about, to what degree do corporations have free speech rights? And the Supreme Court decided in a 2010 case, Citizens United, that they do have some substantial free speech rights in the political context. And now this case potentially raises the question of, do they also have the right, independent religious rights? And if they don't, you know, do they have the ability to sue on behalf of their owners, to vindicate their owners' religious rights?
Well, let me ask you about that. Jesse Chopra explained to us the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. But as I was listening to Mandy Broadfoot in that clip from the Green family, it kept talking about the Green family's beliefs. The Green family believes this and that, rather than Hobby Lobby. So what is the dividing line between the corporation and the owners?
Well, I think that the answer is, you know, as Jesse mentioned, this is a very closely held corporation. The family uses the corporation basically as a tool for its business activities. And the corporation, in some meaningful respect, has operated according to the family's religious principles. So, for example, they don't open on Sundays, and they don't sell certain items like shot glasses that they think are inconsistent with the family's religious values. So to ask where the line is, I think, a very good question. You know, you think about a publicly traded company with thousands of diverse shareholders who have many different religious beliefs, and I think you would say pretty easily that company doesn't really have religion. And I think that there are many people who would argue that the same is true of Hobby Lobby. You know, it doesn't have a soul, it can't pray, and it doesn't have its own religion. The argument the other way, of course, is that when you have, as here, a closely held corporation that is operated by a single family with what seems to be a unified set of religious beliefs and is, in fact, operated in accordance with those religious beliefs, it's a closer question.
And Jesse, you said that this isn't a federal constitutional question at all.
That's right. It comes under, as you mentioned, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But let me say that there's a major difference. It's going to be argued, at least, between this case and Citizens United. When Citizens United was expressing its right as a corporation, as a corporate entity, to protect its profit-making ability by being able to finance, put money into a political election. There's a doctrine in corporations that says that for certain purposes, the phrase used is that you can pierce the corporate veil and go through the corporation, if you will, the veil of the corporation, to the real owners. And that takes place when it is, in fact, at least for the purpose that's being litigated, it is in fact the owners of the corporation and not the corporate entity as such that has its interests at stake. And that kind of line of argument is what the family that owns the Hobby Lobby company is going to argue. They're going to say, well, to the extent that the corporation has rights, it's because we have rights. And for this purpose, the corporation is us. I can give you a quick example of that, and that is that it's easiest in a one-person corporation, in which the one-person corporation doesn't respect any corporate format. They have he or she has a corporation. Why do you have it? Well, for limited liability, ordinarily, maybe for tax purposes in some special circumstance. But what the owner of the corporation does, and this is the sole owner, just treats the corporation as though it were his or her own business. And, of course, realistically, it is that person's business. So, for example, they'll pay personal bills with the corporation's money, mixing funds between the corporation and the person. So, under many circumstances, they'll pierce the corporate veil when those are the facts. That is the sort of argument they're going to say is analogous here. This is not the corporate entity's right so much as it is the individual's right, and they're going to pierce the corporate veil to get it. And that's the argument that I would make if I were representing the Hobby Lobby people.
But then it sounds like you're saying that there is no dividing line between the corporation and the owners.
There is no corporation dividing line.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like make that argument essentially.
If the owners treat it as if there is no dividing line, and they're saying for this purpose, we're treating it that way, and we think this is a wholly legitimate way of treating it, because it is us that is having its religious beliefs compromised if we have to do this. Not this artificial entity known as the corporation.
So then it wouldn't be about corporate personhood at all.
That's what they're going to try to make it.
Uh-huh.
That's the whole point.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join our conversation. This is Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're discussing the legal concept of corporate personhood and talking about the debate over corporations' right to free speech and freedom of religion. And specifically, we're looking at the Hobby Lobby case that will come up before the Supreme Court next week. We're joined by Jesse Choper, who's the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on the Supreme Court. And Tejinder Singh, who's an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. And if you want to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. What First Amendment rights do you think corporations should have in terms of free speech and free exercise of religion? And if you think those rights have gone too far, what can be done to move the pendulum back? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I want to get a little bit more into this kind of question of the rights of companies and the beliefs of their owners to impose those beliefs on their employees. There's a lot at stake for the Greens, who own Hobby Lobby. It's a family-owned company. It has over 500 stores, employs over about 22,000 people. And under this new Affordable Care Act contraceptive mandate, that they could be fined up to $1.3 million a day. But I'm wondering about the employees in this case, the Hobby Lobby employees. Is anybody representing them in the case, Tejinder?
So in this case, their interests are sort of being advanced by the government, which is sort of arguing in favor of the employer mandate. And I think that it is an important point to raise that the employees of the company are the folks whose rights are potentially going to be infringed. And as the government argues that the contraceptive mandate should be enforced, that is going to be one of the arguments they raise. You know, there's this first question that we've been talking about so far, which is whether the corporation is really a person at all. Let's assume for a moment that it is and that it has some rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Even if that's true, that doesn't mean that Hobby Lobby wins the case automatically. they still have to show that the government's imposition on them imposes a substantial burden on their religious rights, and they have to show that what the government's doing is not tailored to achieve a compelling interest. And the government will argue that, you know, there is a compelling interest in protecting the health of these employees, giving them access to good preventive care. And that really is, I think, probably where the case will wind up getting, will wind up landing, is on these sort of latter inquiries, not whether Hobby Lobby has rights at all under the statute, but really whether the there's been a violation of the statute in this case.
Well, and if let's make the assumption that the Supreme Court upheld the Hobby Lobby point of view, I mean, how far could you go? If I believe in only in prayer as a healing, a way to heal, would then I have the right to opt out of all health care for my employees?
How far
would that precedent go?
Right. I think it's very difficult to speculate about this. I think the reason that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed was to encourage courts to make these case-by-case assessments about what what works and what doesn't, what constitutes a substantial burden, what's a compelling interest, to sort of force that case-by-case inquiry. And I think that, you know, if someone asserted a right to just sort of not provide health care coverage at all, then I think, you know, you would have certainly a compelling interest on the side of the government. And I think that a sort of global opt-out would be a big problem for a company trying to avoid enforcement of that mandate. And I think the same arguments will be made just about this sort of health care, you know, preventive care, contraceptive, and even the subset of contraceptives that are issued in this case. I think, though, that this slippery slope question that you raise, it's an interesting one. It's one that we law people have a lot of fun discussing, because anytime there's a legal rule, you can sort of expand it and find ways to take the logic to extremes. But I think that this statute is sort of tailor-made to avoid opening floodgates by encouraging these case-by-case inquiries in every case.
And why don't we go to a couple of callers before Jesse has to leave us. Ken in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hey, good morning. Question, doesn't my right as an employee, I have rights to my health care, and I don't want my employer dictating the type of care I receive. If I need a heart transplant, I don't want my employer to say, we don't believe in heart transplants, it's against our religion because we don't believe organs should be transplanted. I mean, my rights are protected under HIPAA, the Health Insurance Privacy and Portability Act. There's a number of privacy provisions in it. So who is my employer to start dictating the type of health care I receive?
And it sounds like
doesn't
that's exactly
Trump
what the government...
Doesn't right to be to worship an obelisk or whatever?
Your right to health care trumps the right to, of religion. Well, Jesse Chopra, can you answer, Ken?
Well, I'd say my colleague this morning gave the answer, and that is that the standard that governs the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is that there's no absolute right. If it can be shown that there is a compelling government interest in overcoming the claim to religion.
And to gender, I'm sorry, Jesse, your line is so bad we just can't even understand you. Can you answer Ken's question about this kind of whose rights trump whose?
Sure. So, you know, in strict terms, this is not necessarily about a fight between two people's rights. At least the legal framework governing the statute doesn't work that way. The question is not, you know, are the employer's rights trumping the employee's or vice versa? Although that, I think, is really how ultimately the government will frame its interest, right? Hmm. The government has to show it has a compelling interest. And the way they'll do that is they will say, you know, we have a compelling interest in making sure people get the health care they need. And when they say that, you know, they have to show then that the regulation they have in mind is tailored to achieve that interest. And obviously requiring health insurance is a way to do that. And I think that they would ordinarily win the argument that, you know, if you're talking about something like a heart transplant, that would be impossible to get but for health insurance. You know, an employer can't pull the plug on that when the government has decided that the protection of health is, you know, on the table. So the answer, Ken, to your question is, I think that, you know, employers do have some choices in terms of what sort of health insurance plans they offer their employees. Obviously, there are minimum standards that they have to meet. Above those, they're empowered to make a lot of different choices. If there is a clash between the employer's desires and the minimum standards, then as long as the government can show that their interest is compelling, the minimum standard wins. And I think that that could very well happen in this case.
And that's Tejinder Singh. He's an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. We've also been joined by Jesse Choper, who's the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on the Supreme Court, and he has to leave us now. Thank you so much for joining us. We really
I'm sorry about the phone.
Me too. Great to have you on always.
Thank you.
And let's try and take one more call. Let's go to Harvey in Santa Cruz. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about two things. One is the corporate personhood, and secondly, what we here in Santa Cruz County are doing at a local level. Most of the attention of corporate personhood has been focused on the First Amendment, which grants free speech rights and enabling corporations to therefore spend virtually unlimited amounts of money in our elections. But there are several other things that the personhood in the Constitution requires. For instance, it prohibits routine inspections of corporate property without giving permission or getting a warrant. So in often cases, that eliminates the possibility of surprise elections, which means that Company X cannot dump arsenic into the lakes. Secondly, is that it gives also corporations the ability of what we call negative free speech rights, which means that they don't have to tell us what's in their labeling. They don't have to label something that has certain products in it that are might be negative to your health. So that's two other things. There's more, but I won't go into that. Locally,
I just wanted to let you know that you can post information and comments at yourcallradio.org. Go on, Harvey.
Locally, here in Santa Cruz, we're one of five counties in California that are qualifying for the ballot initiatives for the 2014 November elections that would say corporations are not people and money is not speech. The wording of our ballot initiatives is, should the citizens of Santa Cruz County support the United States constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech. This is a grassroots movement that is spreading throughout the country, and I'd like to get some comments from your guests as to what a grassroots movement can do.
Great. Let's get that started, Harvey. We're going to have to go to a break soon, but can you begin this conversation to gender, please?
Sure. So I think there's, you know, absolutely nothing objectionable about the ballot initiative as you've described. I'm not personally familiar with it, so I'm relying on your description here. I think that, you know, there is definitely a cogent argument to be made, and it was made by the dissenters in Citizens United explaining why money should not be equated with speech. And I think that there's a very, very strong argument to be made that the influx of money has been thoroughly damaging to American political life. In terms of, you know, what you can hope to accomplish, well, that's more of an open question. I think that, you know, there's a clause in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause that says, you know, federal law trumps state law. So any state law initiative that is contradictory to the federal Constitution is in trouble. But, of course, what you're calling for here is an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. For a grassroots movement to accomplish that, well, you'd have to – amending the Constitution in this country is actually not that easy to do.
All right, and that's Tejinder Singh. He's an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. We're talking about the legal concept of corporate personhood. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Many ways to take part in the conversation on today's Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website and just leaving a message. If you'd like to join us live on the phone today, the number is toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, live from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, it's This American Life. Here on KALW, San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the stories of migrant farm workers. We'll speak with Seth Holmes, who's the author of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. He spent time living in labor camps, picking fruit, pruning plants, making the trek back and forth across the border, and he'll share his insights into how we get our food. Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're talking about how far the First Amendment should go for corporations, and we're looking at the debate over corporations' right to free speech and freedom of religion. Several companies have objected to the Affordable Care Act mandate to provide employees with coverage for contraception and abortion services. The Supreme Court is going to hear that Hobby Lobby case next week. So what First Amendment rights should corporations have, if any? And if you want to join our conversation, we're at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Do you think there are progressive arguments in favor of protecting free speech and freedom of religion of corporations? And if you think that corporate personhood has gone too far, as did Harvey, what can be done to move the pendulum back? Our toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Tejinder Singh, who's an attorney with Goldstein & Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. And we're also now joined by Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, so you say that corporate personhood is a legal fiction. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a long-established legal fiction that corporations have certain rights of personhood, entitle them to certain things. I think what I was saying is that whatever corporate personhood includes in that basket, it can't possibly include the right to exercise conscience or religion, which has always been seen as an individual right, not the right of a corporation.
And Tejinder, where do you stand on that whole concept of corporate personhood?
Well, I think it's clear. It's exactly what Dahlia said, in the sense that, you know, there are certain rights that obviously corporations must have. And then there are rights at the margins, and then there are rights that they clearly don't have. So, for example, corporations don't get to vote. But this question of religious rights, I think the only reason it's close is because there are corporations, you know, first of all, nonprofit corporations, many churches are organized that way. And to say that they just don't have religious rights, I think, is a little tricky. On the other hand, these for-profit corporations, you have some that clearly don't have religion, as I mentioned earlier. A large publicly traded company like Apple or Google doesn't really have a religion. On the other hand, you have corporations like Hobby Lobby, which are closely held. You know, and so I ask a question, which is, you know, I'm a religious person. If I have a corporation, I'm the sole owner, and basically all I do is I use the corporation to conduct my affairs. Is there a meaningful difference between the corporation and me? And in the first half hour when Jesse Chopra was here, we were talking about that. And I think that it's actually a close question. And I think that the better way to probably decide these cases is not to say, you know, corporations, qua corporations, don't have rights, period, but rather to make these sort of case-by-case assessments that the statute asks courts to make. And under the statute, I would actually say that probably Hobby Lobby should lose this case, but not because they're a corporation.
Not because they're a corporation. Then what would be the legal precedent?
I think the best argument actually against them is probably that this the impositions by what people are calling the contraceptive mandate don't substantially burden their religious freedom. And the reason why is actually there's a law professor at Georgetown named Marty Lederman who's written about this, which is that, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, you actually can, as an employer, if you want to, not provide health insurance to your employees and give them a subsidy to pay a fee to the government. This is different from the $1.3 million a day fines that you were talking about earlier. This is a much smaller fee that you can pay to the government, which will help subsidize those employees buying insurance on exchanges. And so it's actually true. Under the Affordable Care Act, there is no employer mandate to provide coverage. there is a mandate that says if you provide coverage, then it has to meet certain minimum standards, including contraception. And if you don't provide coverage, you have to pay some money to help subsidize the exchanges. And so I think Hobby Lobby has a clean way out of this that wouldn't burden their religious beliefs and would make sure that their employees can all afford the coverage that the federal government says they need to have.
So pardon my ignorance here, but it seems like you're saying because they're a closely held corporation that the Greens' religious freedom is essentially the same as Hobby Lobby's religious freedom?
That might be overstating the point just a little bit, but in principle, that's more or less what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, you know, in my view, there are a range of corporations that I think what we would plausibly say, just sort of in our everyday discussion, are, you know, acting out the religious wishes of their owners. Now, and the question to ask, so I posed the hypothetical earlier of I'm a person and I use a corporation to run my business. Let's say I didn't use a corporation. Let's say I ran the business as a sole proprietorship. You know, should that really make the difference as to whether I'm protected by the statute or not? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure that any of the features of incorporation should be the dispositive features in that case.
Well, let me bring Dahlia into this. How do we then differentiate? Well, I want to hear what your response to gender, but I think the bigger question for me is then how do we differentiate between the human beings who run a business and the business itself, this whole idea of corporate personhood?
Well, I think I completely agree with the proposition that this looks like a trickier case because in both Conestoga and Hobby Lobby, you have family-owned businesses that say, you know, the family is sort of interchangeable with the corporation and that the businesses are run along religious lines. And so this isn't like Apple or Google. You know, Hobby Lobby says, you know, we're closed on Sunday. We start, you know, employee meetings with a Bible reading and a prayer. So I think there's some argument to be made that you can, you know, say these aren't purely for-profit corporations. But the court has never acknowledged that for-profit corporations get to be exempt from these mutually, you know, applicable laws. And so I think you can fudge around the margins. You can say, this isn't quite a for-profit corporation. It's a little different. And it's certainly possible, by the way, that the court, if they want to split the baby, will do what the D.C. appeals court did and say, yes, the right that inheres here is the right of the Green family. It's not the right of the corporation, but a way around it. But I don't think it changes the fact that if you incorporate, whether you do it as a family or you do it as a bunch of owners of a corporation, you get certain protections that include, you know, certain property protections and protections of limited liability, in exchange for which you give up the right to say the corporation is me. And so that's sort of the nature of what we do. It is true that we do have churches, synagogues, religious institutions that are religious corporations, but I don't think under any set of facts Hobby Lobby looks like a religious corporation.
And you wrote about something we spoke about a little bit earlier, touched upon, is the idea of a slippery slope if this becomes precedent. You say if for-profit secular corporations have religious beliefs, companies run by Christian Scientists can be free to limit medical treatment. Those run by Jehovah's Witnesses could object to paying for blood transfusion. Artificially created constructs that exist to shield owners from lawsuits will be able to shield owners from compliance with basic civil rights laws.
Right, and that shows up in the dissents in many of these cases, that judges hold out this slippery slope and say, once you allow the owners of a corporation to say, well, my religious liberty precludes me doing X, Y, or Z, you really are headed down a slippery slope where corporations can be exempted from all sorts of things. And again, I think it's really important to emphasize there's no way to test this. There's no way to say, wait, are these really deeply held religious beliefs, or are these simply beliefs, you know, political or ideological beliefs that you're couching in religious arguments? And, you know, we've certainly seen cases where, for instance, employers don't want to provide benefits to women because they say, well, men should be the head of the household. That's just the way it is.
Well, that's my religious belief, right?
whether it's a religious belief or otherwise, I think it's very hard to test. And one of the things that's so interesting about these cases is how the courts can possibly test the religious conviction, right? You have the medical community saying these, whether it's, you know, an IUD, whether it's Ella, whether it's Plan B, whatever these contraception methods are that the families are wanting to not provide, they don't cause abortions. And you have the bulk of the medical community saying that these are not causing abortions, and religious convictions that say, you know, we don't care what the medical community say, these are our religious beliefs. So now you're not just adjudicating, is this a corporation? You're not just adjudicating, does this violate RFRA or the First Amendment? You're also adjudicating scientific facts.
And that's Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. We're also joined by Tejinder Singh, who's an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're discussing the legal concept of corporate personhood and the Hobby Lobby case that will come up before the Supreme Court next week. And if you want to ask questions about this or join our conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you work at a Hobby Lobby store or any company that's challenged the contraception mandate of the ACA, what's your opinion on this idea of corporate personhood and on this particular case? And do you think that there are progressive arguments in favor of protecting the free speech and religion of corporations? Our number again is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. So to both of you, can you just a lot of cases have actually been brought about this contraceptive clause of the ACA. What have the lower courts said? Go ahead, Tejinder. Do I have you guys?
So the lower courts in these cases are a bit divided. In the Hobby Lobby case itself, it was the government who asked for the Supreme Court's review, and in other cases, you know, the government has prevailed. In general, the parry and thrust of the arguments has been more or less what we've been discussing here. You know, whose rights are at issue? Do they exist? And what does the RFRA statute really require?
And what do you think is at stake here, Dahlia?
Well, it depends entirely on how broadly or how narrowly the Supreme Court chooses to frame the issue. In other words, if it comes down to something quite, quite narrow, which is, is this unduly burdensome on the employer, or does the Obama administration, in fact, have a compelling interest to require that contraception be funded? You know, I think that the consequences going forward are much narrower. I think, obviously, if the court were to decide some, you know, Citizens United 2.0, that, you know, corporations under the First Amendment or under RFRA, you know, are religious persons with religious freedoms the same way they have speech freedoms after Citizens United, that's hugely consequential. And as you said, you know, with your sort of laundry list of what other religious employers might be able to do going forward, I think really, you know, you could be looking down the barrel of, you know, are employees at this point almost completely subject to the religious convictions of their employers? So I think it really does depend on how broad, how narrow the Supreme Court chooses to go.
What do you think is at stake, Tejinder?
It's very hard to disagree with that statement. I think that's 100% right, that, you know, the court can do it big and it can do it small. I suspect the court is going to do it small, whatever it does. You know, obviously, I don't know if it can do it small if it says Hobby Lobby wins. But I think that, you know, Dahlia is 100% right in what she said earlier, which is that, in general, these sorts of challenges have failed, you know. Amish companies have not wanted to pay their Social Security taxes, that kind of thing fails. And the Supreme Court has decided that in the past. So, you know, I'm not sure the exact road they'll use to get there, but I sort of suspect that Hobby Lobby is not going to win this case. And, you know, as a result, I don't think a whole lot is going to change in terms of the way the law goes. If it goes the other way, then I think, you know, you will see an influx of challenges to other sort of generally applicable laws, and you'll see courts engaging in a lot more case-by-case balancing of the interests I don't know that it will result in sort of a tidal wave of laws being suspended or invalidated, but I think what you will see is a lot of litigation.
And Dahlia, you write, progressives can be just as guilty as conservatives when it comes to this sort of metaphorical personhood creep. A suit filed in New York seeks to protect four chimpanzees as persons, too. But whatever you may think of the ultimate goals here, when you designate a non-person as a person, you devalue what it means as a legal and policy matter to be human. Do you think that there is a progressive case for corporations having First Amendment protections? What are your thoughts on that whole idea?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that folks, you know, particularly progressives who just reflexively recoiled after Citizens United, you know, conferred First Amendment speech rights on corporations, weren't looking closely at, you know, the lineup of unbelievable First Amendment scholars from the left who supported Citizens United. There were very, very compelling reasons. There are compelling reasons, right? The New York Times is a corporation. So there are important arguments on the left for conferring personhood rights on corporations. The case was never as simple, I think, as the media made it out to be. But I think that said, in my view at least, there is such a significant leap between conferring First Amendment speech rights on corporations and conferring what I think have to be, by definition, deeply personal, deeply, deeply human rights of conscience and religion on corporations. I just think they're completely not analogous to say that because corporations have, in certain contexts, speech rights, they are somehow entitled to religious rights, which, you know, at least in the case of these for-profit corporations, seems to me to be not just a stretch, but I think it goes back to the quote you just read, seems to trammel the real people who work for Hobby Lobby, right? Hobby Lobby, Conestoga, employ people of all faiths and religions. And so to suggest that the corporate rights, the corporate religious and faith rights of the employer somehow get to swamp the actual religious and other civil rights of employees strikes me as perverse and extreme.
You brought up the Citizens United case and the equation of money with free speech in the First Amendment protection there. How do both of you think that the Citizens United precedent changed the landscape for this type of case, this Hobby Lobby type case? Tijinder?
I think it clearly opens the door in a meaningful sense. You know, Citizens United at the time was a landmark decision because I don't think anyone thought that you know, I think it's clear that it wasn't consistent with prior campaign spending cases, and in fact it overruled, you know, past precedent. And so I think that when you look at the way the public and the media frame the conversation around Citizens United has certainly given a lot of steam to folks who want to say that corporations enjoy sort of the full panoply of personal First Amendment rights, including the right to religion. So you know, I'm pretty sure that without Citizens United, it would be very hard to have Hobby Lobby. That said, you know, the issues are, as Dahlia says, analytically distinct, and I think you can draw a pretty good line between them if you want to.
And what do you think? I'm going to get to another caller in just a minute, but Dahlia, can you just weigh in on what you think the significance of Citizens United was?
No, I totally agree with Tijinder that you know, it is the baseline from which, you know, the plaintiffs in these cases argue. They say, you know, look at Citizens United, why not this? I would also say, just going back to the discussion of whether the Supreme Court wants to go big or go small, that the court is not unaware of the blowback, the national blowback after Citizens United. Its popularity was at its lowest after that. The American public was enraged. And, you know, we can debate all day whether the court should take public opinion into account, but I think it would be a mistake to suggest the court isn't unaware of wading back into that swamp and how unpopular Citizens United really was.
Let's go to Sue in San Francisco. Hi, Sue. Welcome to your call.
Hi, yes. I understand at the beginning of the radio show, and thank you, by the way, for talking to me, that you were discussing the 1880s case, and as I understand about that case, there was no discussion at all about applying personhood to corporations. It was just given as a given, and it's not in the Constitution. I don't know why at some point, if not in this case, in some case people do not challenge the whole idea of personhood, since it's not a constitutional right. It's just was confirmed by the judges in the 1880s.
In 1819, I think. Tejinder, you want to take that?
So I'm sorry, I'm not 100% sure on which case, which discussion you're alluding to here.
It was the railroad case.
The railroad case by Justice, it's the 1819 case that said that corporations have natural rights to make contracts.
Oh, sure.
And, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, and I don't think anyone in any of this discussion disputes the notion that corporations are, for certain purposes, people. You know, I think the only question...
Nobody disputes that?
Right. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone is saying, on the one hand, I don't think anyone is saying that corporations are people the way that human beings are people. On the other hand, I don't think anyone is saying that corporations are, you know, completely, totally distinct from persons or have never been recognized as persons under the law. Of course they have, in a huge variety of contexts, dating back for centuries. And so, you know, the question is really not about corporate personhood versus not personhood. The question is about how many of the rights and which rights incidental to personhood also extend to corporations. You know, what kind of person are corporations is basically the question that we're asking. And I think the right answer is, as Dahlia put it earlier, you know, they're a legal fiction. They're not a flesh and blood person. They're a legal person that we create for the purpose of transacting affairs and making, you know, society function more efficiently.
And
they should have the rights that are essential for them to perform that function.
And I think Sue was alluding to the 1886 U.S. Supreme Court decision recognizing corporations as having the same right as natural persons to contract and enforce contracts. So sorry about that clarification. Go ahead,
can
Dahlia.
Can I just jump in and say, just for Sue's benefit, that the Constitutional Accountability Center has some fun legal history on that case and how actually the wording of the decision in that case got a little bit messed up by the clerk of the court. So the case was reported as holding more than it did hold, and it may have been something of a typographical or clerical error that even represents that case to go as far as it did.
So corporate personhood might be attributable to a clerical error?
Well, I think it was more than clerical. I think that the story, as I understand it, is that the reporter who reported out in the notes what the court had said pushed the analysis and the holding of the case farther than it went. So, a good place to look is at the CAC's website, because they have had a lot of fun with that.
And we'll put a link to that and all of the other information that you're hearing at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there and add information. I just want to bring up another case, a corporate personhood case that went to the Supreme Court. AT&T in 2011, the company argued that it should be granted personal privacy. And in that case, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, personal privacy does not extend to corporations. So how might that play out in the Hobby Lobby case?
I covered that case, and I had a lot of fun covering it, because AT&T was making the argument, slightly rooted in the idea of corporate personhood, that they could suffer from corporate embarrassment and that corporations have feelings in addition to speech rights, and that they would be embarrassed by certain disclosures. And it was a great fun case to cover, because Chief Justice John Roberts made short work of that argument and went through the dictionary definition of, you know, what corporations were and what embarrassment was, and said, heck no, you don't get to feel embarrassed. So, you know, whether the court will take the case into account, it was such an outlier case and such a deeply, deeply strange argument on the part of AT&T. I can't imagine that it is dispositive in this case, but it really was a fun example of corporations trying to take corporate personhood to the absolute extreme.
And we have only about 2 minutes left in the show, but Harvey brought up the idea of grassroots movement to kind of and the status of constitutional personhood for corporations. Who are the big drivers for change? I think that there's a movement to repeal led by Senator Al Franken. What's happening there, Dahlia?
There's various moves. There's moves to amend the Constitution. There's moves to, all sorts of different ways to try to attack the holding in Citizens United. And there's also, I think, all sorts of moves to try to limit the reach of Citizens United so that it doesn't go further than it's gone. But it seems to me that I think Citizens United is done. It's the law. And the question is whether we allow it to push us even further.
And very quickly, Tejinder, what do you think is the possibility for change on this?
Hover is near zero in the sense of a constitutional amendment. You know, I think, as I was starting to say to Harvey, it's pretty hard to do, and I don't expect that there will be sufficient political will for it. On the other hand, you know, the composition of the court is known to change. We're about to have a few retirements, probably in the next 5 years or so, and it's entirely possible that with a different court, you know, these precedents may be revisited yet again.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Tejinder Singh is an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to SCOTUS blog. We'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor for Slate, where she covers the Supreme Court. We'll put her articles at yourcallradio.org. Earlier in the program, we were joined by Jesse Choper, the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What are the stories of migrant farm workers? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Seth Holmes, author of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. Holmes spent time living in labor camps, picking fruit and pruning plants, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border with undocumented Mexican migrant workers. He chronicles the physical and emotional struggles they face making this trek and laboring in the fields. So how do we connect the dots between the fruits and vegetables we eat and the people who suffer to pick them? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. Oh,